I think in a perfect world, we'd see cannabis available in pharmacies, just like any other drug or supplement. And if you don't need the pharmacist's help, great. You know, somebody else will.
This is the Cannabis Enigma, cutting through the smoke to have informed, serious conversations for regular people. I'm Michael Schaefer-Omerman.
And I'm Alana Goldberg. I hear we're going to be talking about chemists today, Mike.
If by chemists you mean pharmacists, then yeah.
Yeah, that's what we call them down under.
So in Minnesota, they call them pharmacists. And interestingly enough, in Minnesota, where our guest today, Dr. Melanie Kane, works as a cannabis pharmacist, they require that a pharmacist be on site at all medical cannabis dispensaries to answer questions, to help patients choose products, and to fulfill the role that a pharmacist would with any other medication.
Yes, yeah, super important.
And like I said, that role can be anything from helping somebody learn how to use a vaporizer for the first time, to looking at drug interactions with other medications they might be taking, and even building a treatment plan.
Yeah, so I guess it's a partially medical role and partially a patient education function.
And it's another resource and point of contact that patients have available to them. So as I said, our guest today is Dr. Melanie Kane. She's a cannabis pharmacist and the co-founder and executive director of the International Society of Cannabis Pharmacists, which is having a conference soon that she'll speak about at the end of the episode. And let's hear the interview.
Let's do it.
Dr. Melanie Kane, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the most obvious question to me, which is, what is a cannabis pharmacist?
So we are regular pharmacists that understand the science and the potential value of using cannabis as a medicine. So in the United States and around most of the world, cannabis is not viewed as a medicine with any potential medical benefit. And so with our understanding of pharmacology and the body, it really helps from our perspective to explain to other physicians and other patients, and of course, other healthcare professionals, what the role of cannabis may be in the body, in disease, and in compassionate care.
And what does that work look like for you, for others?
So my first job out of college, after I graduated and got my Doctor of Pharmacy license, I returned home to my home state of Minnesota, and we require pharmacists in the dispensaries to make clinical recommendations. So the doctor is diagnosing, they see patients, they, you know, look at their medical conditions and determine whether they are a valid candidate to use cannabis. And then they come to the dispensaries where pharmacists like myself are charged with creating initial recommendations, as well as monitoring and evaluating for side effects and other reasons that we might need to change therapy. So not only are we providing direct clinical recommendations, but we can also counsel and educate on drug interactions, side effects, formulations, you know, just like with any medicine, if there's a device involved, whether it's a syringe or if it's an inhaler, there's a technique that is to be used. And a lot of times there's that communication piece, that education piece is missed from the initial consultation or, you know, when the patient is visiting the doctor. So we kind of focus on the drugs.
I feel like that's a piece that's missing for at least most of the places in the United States where medical cannabis has become available over the past decade or so, where, you know, let's say in California, you get a recommendation from a doctor, you go into a dispensary and, you know, you have somebody who doesn't have any medical training giving you recommendations that are probably based on no science at all.
And unfortunately, you know, we're in such a legal regulatory landscape where a lot of states thought that was the best course of action. You have a lot of different organizations lobbying both for and against healthcare professional involvement. I'll give you a personal story. I was walking through the waiting room in between consultations, and I heard one of the technicians, so we have pharmacy technicians, of course, and I heard them on the phone with a patient, and I couldn't hear the patient, of course, they were on the phone, but I could hear the technician, and she said, "Look, ma'am, I don't know what a PE is, but I'm sure you can vaporize just fine. Don't worry about it." And I, like, my eyes bulged, and I thought, a PE is a pulmonary embolism. Like, if you don't know what that is, why are you providing a recommendation on its behalf? So I stopped dead in my tracks, and I said, "Just let them know the pharmacist will call them back." Like, this is the exact ideal situation in which, you know, you have people that might not understand what is that disease state or what is that contraindication, which is really a reason that someone would not want to use cannabis, and using it in a way that is both safe and possibly effective. I think that's kind of the biggest challenge that our healthcare professionals have. It's not just one pill fits all. When I look at modern medicine, you know, we have these pre-formulated tablets and capsules and liquids that are in very precise concentrations, and we study them in thousands of different bodies, and they all have the same response. And, you know, of course, every drug has a side effect or a potential adverse effect. But when it comes to cannabis, the body responds so uniquely that you can't predict what will happen. And I know people will ask me, like, what does it feel like? I don't know. It feels like you need it. If you need to sleep, it'll help you sleep. If you need to increase your appetite, we can do that. Nausea. There's no other medicine that can target so many different symptoms. So it truly is, you know, seen as this this magic snake oil cure-all. And unfortunately, that's because of the education that's put forth. I'll tell you, in pharmacy school, we spent a whole 2 minutes learning about the endocannabinoid system and phytocannabinoids, because we have dronabinol or marinol on the market. And even still, you know, they said, "We never use this in practice. You'd be a fool to recommend it." And they're right. You know, it is a very potent medicine that is more likely to elicit side effects. And patients don't like that. They don't like to feel out of control, out of body, out of mind. And so when I had the opportunity to work one-on-one with medical cannabis extracts and see how not only can you fine-tune the dose and the ratio, but you have all these different formulations that can be tailored to help patients find what they need. And so whether that's a long-acting product or a short-acting product, you know, that's really I consider the beauty of medical cannabis. Because we have that versatility, we can personalize this medicine to the patient's needs. And that's something that medicine has gone away from.
I wanted to circle back to something you said a little bit in the beginning of that answer, which was about interactions and contraindications. We generally do think of cannabis, at least compared to a lot of the drugs that are used to treat, you know, similar conditions, particularly pain, as having a very good safety profile. But there are drug interactions. Can you tell us what some of those are and why it's important for somebody to be able to sort of look at what you're taking and say, you know, "Hey, wait a minute, maybe we should address this differently"?
So there's a few different types of drug interactions. There's the type that, you know, two drugs both cause low blood pressure, and so we can have this additive effect. With cannabis, it's more so with THC. We can see additive sleepiness, dizziness, and that can be very interrupting or distracting for the patient. And so I think with a perfect cannabinoid medicine, we're not causing impairment or intoxication. And I think that's, you know, a clear distinction from what I consider recreational or adult use. That is the goal of therapy, right? Feeling impaired or intoxicated.
Yeah.
So THC has its own potential for drug interactions from a pharmacodynamic perspective, meaning its effect on the body. And then when you have CBD, so everyone thinks CBD is like the safest thing and it should be in the water supply. But I actually, in my personal and professional experience, encountered more drug interactions with CBD. So it is an enzyme inhibitor, meaning it prevents the function or the action of certain enzymes, which typically function to detoxify and get rid of things in the body. And so some of the drug interactions that I've personally seen with it are typically with anti-epileptic drugs, so anti-seizure medicines. I've also seen it with other types of pain medicines or mood medicines, so like antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs. And when you think of the patient population that's gravitating towards CBD or cannabidiol, they are the ones that are seeking its anti-anxiety benefit or seeking its use as an anti-epileptic. And so that's really where we can get into trouble. And I remember having I think he was like 4 or 5 years old, just very young kid coming in. And I'm talking to the parents and I said, you know, he's already taking 3 different anti-epileptic drugs. And I asked, like, when was the last time we took a level of these medicines? And they're like, what? We've never taken a level. I'm like, I'm sure your neurologist is checking the levels. Like, you know, this is something we do. It's quite common in practice. You do a blood test. She's like, no, he's never mentioned anything. The neurologist never recommended that. And I thought, I don't feel comfortable you starting this without getting a baseline level. How are we going to know if it's working or not? Because with a lot of conditions, seizures being a prominent one, I'd say Tourette's is another one. It's a very fine line of symptom control and being very, very sleepy. And again, that's the impairment, that's the intoxication that we want to avoid. And there's other drug interactions that can occur as well, where it may be the cannabinoid prevents that other medicine from working, or another medicine prevents cannabis from working. I read some case reports that anti-inflammatories, so you might know them as NSAIDs, that's like your ibuprofen, your naproxen, your meloxicams. These types of medicines, just the way that they work in the body could potentially decrease the effectiveness of THC as an anti-inflammatory, which in turn is a pain, anti-pain modality or an analgesic. And my favorite story I like to share about my drug interactions is I had a patient using seizures. She was using CBD for seizures, and she was like 19 or 20, you know, not a child, but she was very developmentally delayed. So we didn't have that advantage of being able to talk to her and find out how she was feeling. We could only see the seizures and use that as our course of therapy determinant. So her dad comes in and he says, you know, her seizures are getting worse over these last few weeks. And, you know, I do my typical, what have we changed? What are about her other medicines? And he says, there's been no other changes, but we have increased the dose of CBD. And you'd think you increase the dose of CBD, you're going to have better seizure control. And at this point, the dad had met with like 3 other pharmacists and like nobody could understand why seizures were getting worse. And so I finally said something like, you know, are we holding it? Because it was a liquid. I said, are we holding it under the tongue? Or are we just swallowing it? Because, you know, a lot of these developmentally delayed patients, they have swallowing difficulties. I said, are we putting it with yogurt or something? And the dad was like, no, she has a tube, a G-tube. So we're bypassing the mouth entirely and we're shoving this medicine into a tube and it's going straight into her stomach and her intestines. And I thought, okay, what is the timing between, you know, this CBD and her other seizure meds? He's like, oh, I put them in the same syringe and I just shove them in. And I was like, okay. So I was like, let's do a level and see, you know, what's going on in the body. And sure enough, the concentration of the other seizure medicine, which in this case was levetiracetam or Keppra, as we call it in the United States. And I'll tell you, this is like the neurologist's go-to because it has very little potential for drug interactions. So when it comes back that the level is decreased, and typically when CBD interacts with the medicine, it increases that drug's concentration. You know, my only thought was it must be binding to itself in the tube, binding to each other. So the CBD binding to the levetiracetam, and that's preventing it from being absorbed and utilized and exerting its anti-epileptic action. And, you know, you never know. You really got to rely on your basic understanding because a lot of times it really is that simple. And other times you go down this rabbit hole of all the research that's out there. And, you know, if you're looking at stuff from 20, 30 years ago, it can be conflicting with the reports from 5, 10 years ago. And it makes it definitely more challenging. But just understanding how it works in the body and the potential pluses and minuses thereof, I think that's really the education that's required to evaluate drug interactions.
You said that you got all of 2 minutes on synthetic cannabinoid medicines in pharmacy school. How did you get this education? And is that changing that pharmacy schools aren't teaching this at all?
Yeah. So I started from the beginning. I told that in Minnesota, we have vertically integrated dispensaries. So the same company grows, extracts, processes, and then dispenses these products. And so I said, like, I need to go see the greenhouse. I need to see how the medicine is made, because these are questions I will get asked. And so I kind of started from the seed and worked my way up. And then when it came to understanding how these medicines are being used in the body and for different conditions, I'd say it was really trial and error. I read a bunch of different studies and scientific summaries and meta-analyses, and they were somewhat helpful. I think the most helpful thing for me was learning about the endocannabinoid system and understanding its integral role with every other system. And it kind of made it easier to understand, okay, well, you know, if we are using it for this action, we're probably going to need a lower dose or, you know, a better ratio. And honestly, it's experimentation. You know, I mentioned that this is such a personalized medicine. Not only does, you know, time of day affect your dosing strategy, whether it's AM or PM, but symptom severity, that's another one. But I think them knowing that there's a resource available that has an idea of how medicines work in the body and they interact with each other and, you know, obviously the goals of therapy, I think that is really what kind of eases some anxiety for a lot of our patients. In Minnesota, our average age is around 50 years old. So my youngest patient I've ever had was 2 months old and my oldest was 101. So there's a quite variable spread. Wow. Yeah. And you never really know, you know, how they're going to respond, what's going to happen. But I think you get to a certain point where you're willing to try anything. If the doctor is willing to try cannabis, it tells me that they've already tried and failed every other pharmaceutical option on the market. And I don't want to use the term that they're desperate, but they're willing to try something that's been demonized for the last 80 years. And, you know, I think about how low potency products were, you know, 50 years ago, 10 years ago even. And so these are different products on the market. And now in Minnesota, for example, everything we have is an oil extract. So I don't have the flower in front of me to give to patients. Everything is precisely dosed in a very standardized ratio. And that also makes it easier. Another kind of tactic I employ to help myself understand, as well as other healthcare professionals, utilizing support groups. And when I first started our support groups, I thought, you know, let's do this by condition. Let's do intractable pain, and then we'll do cancer, and then we'll do seizures. And I had one for adults, and I had one for kids. And then, you know, I took a step back and I thought, these are all the same products, right? We're using THC in a vaporizer for this and that and this. And I thought, why am I making it harder for people and siloing people based on their qualifying condition when I'd rather they talk to each other and say, you know what, even though I'm using this for PTSD, I have found it's also helping my sleep. And, you know, that helps my mood the next day. Like, there's all these different cascading effects from the use or the benefit of cannabis. And so that was, I think, very helpful for me to understand, and for patients, you know, being able to talk to each other. We would also invite healthcare professional, like other doctors and physical therapists and occupational therapists, to join these support groups, because their patients are using it. And I know they did not feel comfortable asking them, how does it feel? Are you impaired? You know, these types of questions. And so being able to hear it, you know, just like a fly on the wall, I think was very beneficial for these doctors. And then the other thing that I found was very important was doing regular follow-ups. So typically, if, you know, I think of cannabis as more of like a supplement, in the sense that it's not as heavily regulated as all of our other prescription drugs. And you know, there's really no one enforcing you to get it refilled at a certain time because you use it as you need it. And so I would do these like weekly phone consults just to check in with like new patients, and especially if they were like having side effects, like I wanted them to know that like we'd be calling them, they can call me sooner, but you know, that communication and that connection was being established. And there's so many people that, you know, my favorite story is, you know, 70, 80 year olds using their vaporizer and they don't turn on the battery. So they're like, you know, sucking on this device. It's not heating anything up and they don't know why it's not working. So it's like little things like that. But from that, I call them virtual consults. So from these virtual consults, which I think is all the craze right now with the coronavirus, but right. It really helped me understand, you know, those at-home moments when people are like, okay, I've tried this, it isn't working, what next?
So we talked about how in most other states that interaction with the pharmacist at the dispensary doesn't exist and patients are left on their own. But in more and more states, it's also available without any medical recommendation. And especially with the availability of CBD across the whole country and much of the world these days, you know, at vitamin stores and gas stations even, how do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing as far as, you know, there are some supplements and, you know, over-the-counter medications, treatments that you can get that, you know, you don't need to consult with a medical professional about. But, you know, everything I've heard you say right now makes me think that maybe we probably should.
Yeah, I feel that way as well. It's our mission and vision to see cannabis-based products in the pharmacies. So not only would patients have access to licensed healthcare professionals, but there'd also be a different feeling towards the seeing it as a medicine versus as an intoxicant. And so I don't think CBD belongs in gas stations. I also think, you know, and I mentioned this earlier, a lot of people turn to cannabis as a last resort. And if you're self-medicating incorrectly, you're going to get more frustrated, spend more money, and, you know, that in turn can make your disease state worse. Just the stress of not knowing and not feeling good. And so what I like about our organization, so we have a little over 300 pharmacists across the United States, and we do have some in other countries as well, but predominantly the United States. And in the states where cannabis is legally available to adults, we're seeing more and more pharmacists developing their own consultation practice. So a lot of pharmacists do something called MTM. It's medication therapy management. And you're basically, you know, going through the patient's medicines. And it's very easy to see, okay, these are the medicines you're taking. These are your medical conditions. But still having that conversation, because our doctors love using things off-label. So sometimes just seeing the drug doesn't necessarily mean that's their diagnosis. So having that one-on-one conversation, identifying their goals of therapy, which is basically the symptoms they're looking to treat. And then from that, making a recommendation for cannabis. And like I said, it's dynamic, you know. I wish everyone would get it right on the first try, but you don't know how you're going to respond, and we don't know how it's going to interact with the other medicine. So from a safety perspective, we'd rather start low and see no change versus start and have a side effect, because the side effects of THC can be very uncomfortable. They're not life-threatening in any way, shape, or form. It's definitely the safest drug I've ever dispensed. But if you have that feeling of anxiety or dysphoria, or, you know, if you're expecting it to make you sleep and it doesn't and you're up all night, I think that can be very discouraging to patients. And it's kind of depressing. You know, you're like, oh my God, this is supposed to put me to sleep. What's going on? So anyway, these consultant pharmacists, they're doing well by creating this business model in these legal states. And again, there's very little oversight, but I always tell my members, you know, make sure that you have proper signed informed consent. Make sure your patients know that this is an experimental therapy and it's not FDA approved. You know, little things to just cover ourselves and really help align the patient's expectations with reality. But I think in a perfect world, you know, we'd see a couple things. We'd see cannabis available in pharmacies, just like any other drug or supplement. And if you don't need the pharmacist's help, great. You know, somebody else will. I like to also think that, you know, it would then normalize its use as a medicine. So if you have a seizure patient coming in for who knows what reason, they're going to the hospital and they're admitted, you know, I would not feel comfortable stopping someone's seizure medicine if it's controlling their seizures, because then you run into the risk of, okay, now you're going to throw off their levels. They're going to seize. They're going to be in the hospital longer. It's more expensive. And, you know, just looking at it from that perspective, it makes it very difficult. Now, the current advantage that we have right now is that we do have one commercially available FDA-approved CBD, and that's Epidiolex. And so I know a lot of hospitals are physically switching people when they're admitted from their CBD to Epidiolex, which is standardized, controlled, makes it a little bit easier for doctors to dose. But, you know, until we have that normalization, patients are the ones that suffer. Another thing I like to point out while I have your attention, not getting into the politics here, but when we legalize adult use of cannabis, we are effectively ignoring the medical programs, and the people or the populations that will most benefit from these medical programs are the very young and the elderly, because you're not going to have a 85-year-old going into a dispensary trying to figure out what works for them, right? That's not really the most likely person coming in. And so too, you know, kids can't use adult use programs without that medical permission, if you will.
Right.
So I think as much as we, you know, need to free the plant and not criminalize its use for people trying to seek relief, but we also need to consider the regulatory challenges in doing so, because, you know, these are the most vulnerable populations. These are the ones that need it the most and could benefit the most, really. And so that's just kind of my two cents about that.
How much of all that change you're talking about comes down to educating the medical community?
It's very important to educate the medical community. However, I think it's society itself that needs to be educated, because even when doctors say, you know what, this might be a good choice for you, you know, they are adamant. They're like, what will my church think of me? What will this think of me, my community, my neighborhood? And it's like, they're not feeling the symptoms you are. Why would that alter your decision? And so just that public stigma that's in society that accompanies using cannabis, I think that's really what needs to change. And I think when you have more healthcare professionals that are actively involved in advocating for its safe use, I think that is ultimately what changes society. So if we have educated healthcare professionals, patients and other healthcare professionals will feel more comfortable turning to these, I don't want to say experts, but, you know, experts in their field. That's one reason that we've created the Clinical Cannabinoid Pharmacy Conference and subsequent certificate program, because there's so much to know about cannabinoids and a lot of people have difficulty learning where to start. So our first series for 2020, and this is going to be August 14th and 15th, and it's virtual, of course, with our current state of pandemics. But our first series is really looking at the basics, understanding phytocannabinoids and the endocannabinoid system, and how to medically use compassionate care to dose cannabinoids. And then, you know, day two, that's really going to focus on more advanced patient populations. So your geriatric, pediatric, your pregnancy and lactating. And I think another kind of black hole in all of medicine, but especially cannabis, are the psychiatric conditions and contraindications. So we're very excited to have Dr. Dustin Sulak, Dr. Bonnie Goldstein. We have pharmacologist Linda Klumper is joining us. And then, you know, other pharmacists, doctors, and everyone we have is physically practicing in their field, which I think also helps the attendees really learn from the experts. So after this 16-hour accredited conference, and you can get continuing education credit for it, There is an optional certificate exam. So we're very excited. More information is available on our website, cannabispharmacist.org. And then in the top toolbar, you'll see Clinical Cannabinoid Pharmacy Conference 2020.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael.
I'm Michael Schaefer-Omerman. This episode was edited, produced, and mixed by myself with production assistance from Matan Whale. If you liked what you just heard, please like, subscribe, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find us, and, well, it makes us happy.